I welcome everyone to the end of April Dean's Corner meeting. We've had them pretty quickly, one right after another here, but there are so many things we need to talk about. We really do need to consistently meet. Today, the main thing that we're going to be doing is having Pierre Barbary, who's Associate Director for University Safety and Head of Security Services, and Chantal Berton, Operations Administrator, Prevention and Statistical Analysis at Security Services, talk with us again about what we can do in terms of safety given the events of our times, but also just in general. Most of what they're going to be talking about really comes down to how to keep people safe and how do we stay safe. So I'm going to turn it over to them very quickly, and then we will have our normal way of operating. Bruna is online, and people can ask questions. At the end, you can ask questions of Pierre and Chantal, and then of the series of presenters afterwards, we will go through the normal topics of HR updates and facilities updates and whatever. So be sure and ask questions from afar as well. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Pierre. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Colleen. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having us here today. Sorry. It's our pleasure to be here and talk to you about safety when it comes to, a little more precisely, to occupations and disruptions. As we all know, the last several months have been somewhat busy, to say the least, when it comes to civil unrest and incidents on campus and city streets surrounding our campus. So what we decided to do is try to meet as many departments and units as possible in order to present this presentation to talk about and exchange roles and responsibilities on everyone's end, including ours. And so we developed protocols, standard operating procedures, if you wish, and in doing so, in order to remit these to the McGill community. And we did go about with our own best practices, but also with best practices throughout our university, our sister universities throughout the city, the province, and actually throughout Canada also. So we did communicate and talk to people and see what others are doing. So that's where we came about with this presentation. So we're going to look at a definition, a purpose, and prevention response with regards to occupations, response with regards to disruptions, post-disruption, and then answer any questions. But we keep those at the end, but please don't wait until the end. If you have questions or comments, please let us know, and we'll definitely answer those. Okay. So like I mentioned, these are recommendations and guidelines that were put together for everyone's benefit, but in consultation with others. Well, to start off with occupations, as we know, last November 10 was an occupation of the James Administration Building, and then another one, more lengthy one, in February 7th to the 11th to the 12th, 5-day occupation of the James Administration Building. So obviously we have learned from our experiences and are constantly trying to improve our response and our prevention techniques in order to try to minimize the chances of future occupations. So an occupation is a form of protest characterized by the willful occupation of space belonging or symbolic to the entity against which the occupation is being staged. Generally, the primary objective of the occupation is to occupy space, maintain the occupation until the protesters' demands are met. The occupation of space is their primary goal. Occupiers do not generally intend to physically harm others. I'm not going to say carte blanche that there's no way they're going to harm individuals, but I'm also telling you that's not their goal. Their goal is to occupy the space, get the individuals to leave that space, and then show that they are now in charge. So prevention is key, so I'll let Chantal move into the prevention aspect.
I'm part of the prevention unit along with Alexandra Gregorian. We're community relations and prevention. And we give a lot of presentations on campus, and we often customize presentations. But what is common to all of them is that we give these best practices. McGill University is often regarded as a public institution, but there are many spaces that are in fact private, and offices that are secure, they're guarded with card readers and whatnot. And so, you know, what we want to get across is that, you know, you should treat your office and your areas, particularly secure areas, like your home. You wouldn't walk away from your home unlocked, and you wouldn't let anyone just wander around your house. So we're getting you to think of that idea that your space, if you see suspicious individuals around or people that don't necessarily belong, trust those instincts. You know, we're supposed to carry our ID cards. You can go up to them very politely, ask them if you can help them, ask them who is it that you want to see, and they should be able to respond in a very intuitively correct way. If you're having problems or if you feel uncomfortable, you really shouldn't hesitate to call us. Call 3000. We'll send somebody. They know the protocol. They know how to, you know, determine whether these people belong there or not. But really what's key is pay attention to who's in your environment, who are in your areas. Treat your office like your home. Keep your doors closed. And again, that's all about controlling movement of people. And refrain from giving access to private areas. And this really brings us to piggybacking, which is a huge problem on campus. Again, you know, your card readers, they're there for access control. So don't be afraid to tell the person behind you, swipe your card. I have access here. Do you have access? Again, if you're uncomfortable, you can just ask them for their ID card in a polite way. It doesn't have to be a confrontation. It shouldn't be a confrontation. You want to keep yourself safe. You always want to have that in mind. But piggybacking, you can always be leaving people, whether it's residents or whether it's in your office, into areas where they don't belong. If you're in a situation where there are people, individuals that obviously want to get into your area, and now we're talking more of an occupation scenario, then don't be afraid to keep that door between you and them. And so if there's a window, communicate through the window. If there's a communication buzzer, use that. That's what it's there for. And that way you contain, they're not supposed to be in the secure areas, and we go into this a little bit later in the next slide, actually, in terms of best practices with data, because if people are in your office, there's a lot of data. I don't think we realize how much sensitive data, student files, you want to think about keeping keys for filing cabinets, and we talk about practicality with security. It's not always practical, but if you make it a habit, then it becomes a day-to-day practice, and then it's less onerous. So we want you to think about maybe a unit strategy where you every night you lock up your filing cabinet. Every morning somebody opens it. And then if there's a scenario where there are people in an area or your office and there's an occupation, then you already have a practice in place. So, you know, just developing best practices. Consider locking or hiding your keyboard. Again, this is more of an occupation scenario, but again, as a best practice, put your keyboard away. There's software and there's hardware out there. Hardwares emit a signal, and people who want to get data from your computer can use the software or hardware. And that's why we're recommending you to put away your keyboard. They can get your password, and then obviously they have access to your computer. So, I mean, what I want you to take away in terms of prevention is this can happen every day. It doesn't have to happen in a disruption. It doesn't have to happen in an occupation. It's just a best practice. Less theft happens, and less data theft happens. And then, again, the safety of your colleagues and yourself is better when you practice these things on a daily basis. We always want you to think about calling security, call 3000, or the police if necessary. And this is, again, not related to disruptions or occupations. It's more you're at McGill, and if anything happens, there are suspicious individuals, you should always feel like you can call 3000. If you're calling from, let me see, if you call the police, try to call from a landline, because the reason for that is that we're monitoring 911 calls on campus. So if you're calling from a cell phone, call us afterwards. That's what's really important also to remember here. And letting us know that you've called the police. It's a big campus. It's not always evident the addresses that that are given, 840 Sherbrooke, I think. Not 840, 855 Sherbrooke. We need to help the police get in onto campus, and that's why we monitor 911 calls.
Yeah, our civic addresses at McGill, some of them are pretty confusing, right? Like Chantal was saying, 845 Sherbrooke is the James Admin building, so try to find 845 Sherbrooke on Sherbrooke. Mm-hmm. You won't find it, right? So what we would do is we'll send, once the 911 call comes in, we monitor it. Obviously, we'll send a patroller to the exact location, but we'll also send a patroller to a designated location in order to escort the emergency vehicles, be it fire, ambulance, or police, to the exact location. So that's obviously the primary reason why we call 911, we monitor 911. We will ask you if you are trying to call 911. We have about a 2-second window, so answer quick. Because if you say, once you say no, we definitely hang up. If not, the call automatically goes to 911. We don't intercept the call. We just are asking you if you are trying to reach 911, because sometimes misdialing, you know, the outside line is 9, and if you're doing a long distance, you have to start with 1, and maybe you double click on the 1, and it's automatically a 911 call. Okay, so, and we'll hang up on you, so please don't take it personally, but we just don't have the time to continue the conversation. If there's no answer at the other end, we know where the call is coming from, we will send somebody over. We'll call first, and then we'll send somebody over. Okay. Like Chantal said, if you do make the call with your cell phone, they'll call us right away, because we want to do the same thing, right? We want to send a patroller over to the location. If you're two individuals, one could call 911 from the cell, and the other one with their other cell could call 3000 at the same time. So responses in occupations. Placing the building on card access mode, we may evacuate the entire building, although only one or several floors are occupied. Taking the decision to evacuate or not depends on several factors. So please rest assured that we won't evacuate a building just to evacuate a building. So if you're asked to evacuate, please do so. There's a reason why. We ask for your full cooperation. We're going to get into a few slides on this, and you're going to say, geez, he's tiring with this. But I'm going to stress this. We have enough to deal with when it comes to disruptions and occupations of individuals that don't cooperate with us, that I count on people that are on our side to cooperate with us. Because it puts our lives in danger when we have to negotiate with an individual to leave their lab, to leave their office or whatnot, to get outside due to a fire alarm or due to an occupation or whatever. Help us clear the building as quickly as possible if you're asked to do so. So I'm definitely, if there's one thing I ask that you take away from today's presentation, it is that. I hope you take more away, but I hope that one at least. So Chantal, I'll get into two scenarios with regards to occupations. Okay.
So if you're in the office or floor which is being occupied, and then the other one is going to be in the area of a building which is not being occupied. Again, if you feel unsafe or threatened, and you feel it's unsafe for you, call security services or the police. Exit the building immediately if it's safe to do so. Sometimes it's not. So again, depending on the situation. If you feel it's safe to remain in your office, I think this is a really good idea. You go back to your office, you let us know what's going on, because we're not necessarily privy to what's going on. So again, extra eyes are always really great. And then think about what you need to do in terms of your data and the safety of yourself and other colleagues. If maybe you've made a plan, you're going to meet outside of the libraries, whatever it is, just, you know, to collect your thoughts, lock away your keyboard, your filing cabinets, put away all your information, and let us know what's going on. Again, closing and lock your door. For us, it's about containment. So, you know, moving around, opening doors gives opportunities for people who really, I mean, if their idea or their intention is to occupy space, they usually want to occupy a lot of space. So particularly if you are working in an office where there's a lot of sensitive data, we want you to close those doors. Log off your computer, but don't turn it off. That's hopefully when we're not running into the situation. But if you're away from campus for 2 or 3 days, there's an extended occupation, you need to be able to work you want to be able to work, rather, then you can use a remote login. Then putting your keyboard in a secure location or out of sight. If you're in the office or floor which is being occupied, continued, we want to be letting you know that you shouldn't be just standing idly by. It's fascinating. It can be socially fascinating to watch events unfold. I've done it myself a couple of times, but really the safest place is in the office or exiting the building. It's again about the safety of yourself and colleagues. Don't engage with protesters. They're there. They have, if it's a disruption, they're usually there just to disrupt as much as they can. Engaging with them, what we really recommend is that you just pay attention, be a good witness. We don't want you to engage because it can lead to an escalation. Avoid walking around. I talked about this a little bit earlier in terms of doors, and we want as many doors closed so that we don't have more breaches of other offices. Staying in your office, you help minimize the risk of other areas being occupied. This is more about evacuation procedures, and Pierre touched on this a little bit earlier. It's really critical that you follow the instructions of the floor's evacuation leader. I don't know what type of plans libraries have, if there's a cohesive plan, but certainly in cooperation with evacuation leaders who are usually working with security services, you follow the instructions, seconds count, and you're usually given enough time to return to your office and do what you need to do. But it's, again, really important not to, deliberate with your evacuation leader or security personnel. Why are we evacuating? How come I have to go out this door? The plans are usually taken very seriously, and the doors are selected. We're receiving all sorts of intelligence. We have a lot of eyes on the ground. We have intelligence coming in from outside external agencies. So these doors are selected for very good reasons, and it's all about containment. So follow the instructions. Again, and exiting the building through the door indicated by evacuation leaders or security personnel. If you're in an adjacent building, I see this all the time, particularly with James and Min. We happen to be right beside. And even though it's not happening in my building, I'm thinking about my perimeter doors. So, if I see a lot of people outside of James and Min, I'm very cautious and I'm very mindful that my doors can represent an additional opportunity for breach. So, if they're getting frustrated around James and Min, then we often see them come to our building. So again, it's about awareness and it's about keeping protesters outside and peaceful and not leading to situations where there are protesters everywhere and there are now even more areas that we have to worry about.
I'd like to weigh in on the previous story. I'll go back yet, just 2 slides. On what Chantal just mentioned in terms of following instructions and exiting the building. These are not just protocols that we drew up. We, with live experiences that we've had in the last several months, I could talk to you about situations and live situations that put you into more of a context for you to understand what type of situations we're in oftentimes. November 10th, where a group of students entered the James and Min building and went up onto the fifth floor and occupied the principal and provost area. Then a call went out to the huge demonstration that was going on in front of Premier Charest's office in terms of students getting beat up by security and whatnot. So incited a riot onto campus, and these individuals, when they arrived, surrounded the James building trying to enter any which way to come and save their friends. So we surrounded the building, monitored, obviously secured the building, but individuals were still pushing our staff to get in. We were pushing back, and we still had people inside the building trying to evacuate them from the building for their own safety. And an individual did not adhere to our request to use a particular door, used that other door that we didn't want to be used. That pushed my two staff members into the crowd even further in, opened the door, then the crowd rushed in, trampled two of my agents, and then 10 more people were on the second floor occupying now. So there are reasons why we ask and urge and encourage, and I don't know which other adjective I could use, when we're asking to evacuate. Okay, so it really is critical. So with this, disruptions, demonstrations or disruptions can escalate whereby buildings are surrounded and serious attempts are made to breach an area or entire building. About 2 weeks ago, again, it's the James building, but that's where it's happening these days. Group of individuals, not necessarily McGill students, looked a lot younger, about 40 or 50 masked individuals, surrounded the James building and was trying to find any which way to enter the James building, including onto the roof of the James Annex, and trying to get into to some windows. So when individuals are trying to get in, they'll do anything they can to get in there. So again, whatever we can do as a group to help minimize those chances is key. So I won't repeat all this because, like I said, this is really important for us, but I think you understand it. Post-disruption. We have several courses, and by the way, there's literature on the table there for you after this presentation. Please help yourself. We offer several courses when it comes to personal safety, and one of them is nonviolent crisis intervention. I'm not sure if some of you have taken this course or not in this class, but it's been given since 2003 here at McGill, and to over 700 individuals, and it's a full-day course that I highly encourage unit heads to allow their staff members to take the time to attend this course. I really highly encourage you. It's not just for occupations, demonstrations. It's for everyday life, everyday safety. It gives you tools and techniques on how to handle difficult situations, not necessarily on a physical level, but more on a verbal level. Although we do touch on the physical aspect in the second half of the course in the afternoon. So I highly encourage you to take that course. It will give you tools. It will give you confidence in dealing with difficult situations. And to register, just call our Josie, our administrative assistant. She'll guide you on how to register. What we can also do is set up a class just for a particular group, up to about 12 individuals. And of the same unit, and we'll come down and give that course to you all. If not, okay, great. So if not, there's courses that are given sporadically throughout each semester, and then we have different units represented in those classes. Just a reminder, obviously we all know about EAP, but we thought it would be important that we just add the slide in terms of our employee assistance program. Should anything happen that you need help with or you need to talk to someone or whatnot, we just thought it'd be important to remind everyone of the EAP program. Chantal touched on it a little bit earlier in terms of being a witness and being on the lookout and paying attention to what's going on in your area. Should an occupation occur or should a demonstration enter your area? It is important because we may need to talk to you to get your account in order to build the case that needs to be built to proceed with the next steps. Should you wish to lodge a complaint, we will ensure that we let you know how to do so. I can't tell you to lodge a complaint. What I can tell you, though, is that if these situations involve students, for example, if we want the process to proceed in terms of disciplinary matters, we need a complaint. Not here to tell you to lodge one. I'm just telling you, that's what we need in order to get the process going. Our reports are not sufficient. We need someone to say, this demonstration disturbed my class or disturbed my area of work or disturbed my area of study, and then that will get the ball rolling with disciplinary process. Same thing on the HR process, I think, but Isabel would probably be able to touch on that a lot more than I would. But we need that type of... Keep your eyes open, ears open, and know that we may have to touch base with you to get more information. And that's it in terms of the formal presentation. We're definitely available for any questions or comments, anything. Either one-on-one after or now, it's up to you. If you want to use the mic, but I don't know if there's... Sure. I think you're going to have to use the mic for the... Yeah, please. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
This is more a general security mm-hmm. question, and I'm not sure whose jurisdiction it is, really, because... incident reports, when something mm-hmm. happens in the space that you're working in... Before I became a librarian, I worked in hotels. So like libraries, people can wander in off the street. Right. There's a lot of theft. They're targeted. And if something happened, an incident report was filled out and it was shared with all staff because security is everybody's job. Mm-hmm. And if everyone's aware that this is happening, there's been a real blitz, then you know we can all be on the lookout. And then when I worked in a public library before coming here, we had the same procedure. We had a form we always filled out, and we were kept informed if stuff was stolen or if people were dealing drugs in the bathroom or what have you.
Never at McGill.
No. or much worse, actually. would that be possible? And I don't know if this is a question for my administrators or for security. And then our security guards that we have contact with are contracted right. out, so okay. it's complicated.
It is, and thanks for bringing that up, because I did bring it up in a previous presentation yesterday. I forgot, I omitted to do this. Let me touch base on the last part of your mm-hmm. comment, which is agency personnel, uniform personnel. We have a hybrid approach here at McGill Security, where our admin and support staff, along with our management team members, are McGill employees, and the uniform personnel you see out there are contracted out, but are, like the agents in the libraries, they are assigned to the McGill contract, okay? We do have what we call special agents, which are called in for special events, be it strikes, demonstrations, OAP, convocation, whatever. All sorts of events will call the agency in to send us some more individuals. So it's important for you to understand they are a contracted agency, but they report to us in terms of procedures, guidelines, and whatever needs to be done, the standard operating procedures don't come from the agency, they come from us. So they report to the operations manager, who's Christopher Carson, and so everything, they represent us, okay, in the best way possible, and I hope they're doing a good job. But know that they do work and are representing us, okay, for that. Going back to the incident reports, you're asking, should there be incidents in the libraries, for example, can that be public knowledge?
Yeah, I personally want to know if three laptops right. were stolen up here in the Life Sciences Library right. last week, because that might happen in the library that I work right. in this week, and I can, you know, I'm working also in public service, I should say that, so I'm on the front lines, and right. I can let students know, I can be on the lookout. Right. I know, I mean, we're all drowning in email and paperwork, so this is, right. it could be a lot more of that, but I mean, the way it was handled where I was before working here was there's a new incident report on the shared drive, and it was everyone's responsibility to quickly check it out and know what was happening. Also, it's a good resource. If you're working by yourself or you're not sure of something and something's kind of ringing a bell, you can refer back and say, okay, is that the guy that, or right. is that description matching the description from this incident, you know, a month ago?
Yeah, we have to be careful with the distribution of incident reports. First of all, once a crime is committed, it goes to Alexandra's desk, and then a file is open in terms of an investigation file. So once an investigation is underway, there's not necessarily too much information we can share. What we do, and if we're not doing enough of it in libraries, and we could definitely verify that with Chantal and Alex, is we do a lot of tabling events, and we do a lot of prevention and poster blitzes in terms of what's going on in certain libraries or certain buildings. So if laptop thefts are an issue in the last 3 months in a particular area, we'll go to that area and almost inundate it with information about thefts that are occurring. Not necessarily descriptions per se of individuals. That, too, we have to be careful, because the sharing of information, if we have a suspect, we can't publish the picture of an individual that hasn't been accused or found guilty.
Yeah.
So we have to be careful of that. And there's names sometimes in incident reports of victims and whatnot, and we can't share that either. So there's privacy laws, especially when we're talking about a huge campus like McGill. This is a city within the downtown core, right? Mm-hmm. So not to say I don't trust you, but there's information that if I share with one individual, I can't control once I've shared it. Versus in one entity, or I'm not going to minimize, a hotel is a big place, but if it's one building, for example, I could pretty much control who gets access to what I'm giving them. Mm-hmm. So that's where we have to balance the, we want to get out there and let people know about this theft or these thefts that are occurring. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, in the same time, we need to be careful, because there are things that we do that others that you may not know we're doing during a blitz or whatnot.
I have seen a lot of the posters and
okay.
the good awareness.
No, but I'm talking more behind the scenes.
Okay.
Because we do blitzes where we'll try to nab the individual.
Mm. Oh, like stings.
Yeah. So we, you know, so I, that's where we have to balance. But if there's issues where you think, wow, there's, and we keep stats, right? And yeah. what actually Chantal's statistical analysis responsibilities is to see where are the trends.
Like chart, yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And then concentrate there.
Okay, I guess to your knowledge on campus, are there groups on campus that make it a practice to fill out an incident report and share that with their employees?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, it's something we could do potentially, I guess.
Like I said, it's almost a case-by-case basis, and we have to feel that the doing that far outweighs the repercussions we may get by doing it. You know, like I said, I can't share photos.
Oh, yeah, no.
I can't share, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm
so,
not, and that's not what I'm proposing at all. Yeah. Did you have something to add? Come, yeah.
Just to add, thank you for bringing that up. I think what we should do is try to figure out what can we report, and if there's a rash of laptop thefts, we notify people, or if there are sort of general trends that are happening, but I think we'll take your question back and see what we can do in light of the privacy laws.
It's just something I'm curious about.
How
we
can handle that,
Okay.
We'll take that.
On a positive note, I know we're talking more than less than positive. I'm not sure if you're aware, but last week or early this week, where there were two arrests of individuals that in the libraries last week, I think. With possession of laptops and iPhones and iPads and iPods in their bags. So we're really happy that we nailed a few individuals on that end, because then that word gets around, right? Because if it's too easy to steal at a certain location, obviously thieves will concentrate in that location. Once a situation occurs that there were arrests, it kind of like pushes them away for a little while. We have a very, even though we're talking about safety, sorry, I don't want to take your time up there, but we have a very safe campus, okay? I know we're talking about situations that are volatile or hostile at times, but for a campus that's right in the middle of downtown Montreal, we have a very safe campus, okay? I'm a board member of an international association of campus law enforcement administrators, and when I tell them my biggest crime is laptop thefts, and they're telling me about assaults and murders and aggravated assaults and sexual assaults on a daily basis, we are a safe campus. That's not to tell you to let your guard down, though, because we prone walking in pairs, and we prone don't have to be out there at night. Don't be out there at night. And if you have to be, you could call us, and we'll walk you to the metro or to your vehicle. Know that also. That's important for all of you to know that. But we have a safe campus. But yes, we have our thieves. We really do, and we try as much as possible through prevention and our presence to minimize the chances. Sorry.
Thank you. Many of us have our working spaces out in the open, very mm-hmm. much part of the public space of right. the library. Do you have any suggestions for us on how, if there were occupiers or something mm-hmm. happening in our library, how to remain safe when we don't right. have a door to close?
Right. There's still things happening out there while I'm in here. If you're in a public space and obviously, like you said, you don't have a door to close or secure yourself in the back, know that in an occupation, like I mentioned in a previous slide, they're there to occupy your space. They're not there to harm you. Take a deep breath. Figure out where you want to go, if it's the nearest office or the nearest cafeteria in your area. I'm not sure what your area is. Then go there. They're not going to stop you from egressing your area. And the reason why they can't do that is that's unlawful confinement, and that's a very hefty charge on a criminal nature. So they'll tell you, you're free to go. Okay? So know that. I mean, if they start physically restraining you, they've just notched it up a huge notch in terms of their charges that they'll be laid. And for your safety, obviously, we'll react immediately. But that's what I recommend, is that we talk about doors and locking doors. But what I recommend is, if you don't have a door to lock, take that deep breath and walk away. They're not going to stop you from walking away. That's the best I can tell you for an open area.
Hi. Just wanted to say that I think we all recognize that the libraries are very open space on the front lines, very public. So it's easy for us as library employees to feel very much as though we're at high risk. Mm-hmm. And I hope that security services and university safety will partner with us in helping to plan exercises, not necessarily that are reactive. I feel in this instance that we have these protesters occupying, and now we're hearing what are best practices that we could do if there's an occupation. But to get that information ahead of time so that we're able to react in an appropriate way given a situation for which we could be high risk. I don't want to be an alarmist, but you know, I also recognize that there are universities in the city where we've had active shooters. So coming in, doing a tabletop exercise with us, putting us into a scenario where we have to react, would be very, very useful for the library community. So I great hope point. That's something that you'll consider.
That's a great point. We have a few years back, following Virginia Tech, we found funding in order to create an emergency measures group team, because we didn't have that in the past in terms of planning exercises and planning and getting pamphlets and doing presentations on different scenarios that could happen. So we have that unit that plans for these, and it's under Claude Lahaye, Emergency Measures and Fire Prev. So they're definitely, they'll be willing to work with you in terms of figuring out what they can do for libraries in terms of, like you said, a tabletop or presentations and whatnot. I want to touch on active shooter. Active shooter presentations are available through my office anytime you want them. I'm the one who gives the presentation. I've given many of these. It just takes, I mean, we do publicize it. We do advise individuals to attend, encourage individuals. It's unfortunate, though, that sometimes, I mean, I was actually in this amphitheater about a year ago for active shooter, and I had three people show up. So it's unfortunate that individuals think that it won't happen to them, but if you look around, we had Dawson, Polytechnic, Concordia, all in our vicinity. I still haven't found one North American city that's had three active shooter situations in their city, in their respective towns. So it does happen. It doesn't only happen in the States. It doesn't only happen in Europe. It happens here also. Again, I'm not trying to be alarmist, but those are techniques that we can give you. And like we're doing today on disruptions and occupations, active shooter will give you techniques NVCI will give you techniques. The courses and presentations are there. We're willing to come and talk to your groups anytime. Anytime. Like I told Bruna and Colleen, this is my relaxing moment right now to come and talk to you. Okay, I'd rather do this than deal with what we've been dealing with for the last 6 or 7 months. So if you feel you're not getting or you feel you need, go through your respective unit heads and they'll contact us and we'll arrange some type of training, some type of presentation, exchange, whatever is best for your group. And I urge you to do it.
Or far, we have 62 people watching. So
good.
It may be maybe you're a hot topic.
I guess. Yeah.
So any questions, Bruna, from any place?
No.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I just have to say thank you
Isabel.
Sorry,
yeah, Isabel.
I just okay. Yes.
I have to do it. Okay. We saw in the past few weeks that the level of aggressivity and frustration has raised, and we're not too sure of what to expect when we come to work. We get out of the metro, if we're lucky enough, and there's no smoke bombs in the metro, right? And we hear the helicopter, and we're never sure what's going to happen at work that morning. And then there's this fine line when a group of protesters comes in the library. Do we lock the door? Do we let them in? It's exam period. Everybody's tired. Everybody's stressed. I know that the police has a definition. When does it become illegal? Mm-hmm. And when are they going to get the riot gear out and start, you know? What is the process for security to assess the situation? Do we lock the doors or do we let them in? Do we confine the way? Because sometimes when the door is locked, this is when they're going to start destroying and breaking windows versus...
Yeah, good question. Thanks. We assess through... I mean, we have eyes everywhere. When as soon as the sun rises at 6 a.m. until... Well, last night was pretty late. I went to bed pretty late. Bruna could attest with all the emails and updates I was giving her until like midnight. We assessed. I mean, what happens is when we find out about a demonstration that's going to occur and coming down, because as we know, our location is not ideal, right? I mean, Premier Charest's office is right across the street. The Quebec offices are at Lotto Quebec, which are across the street from our music faculty and at Carrefour Sherbrooke residence. So even if they don't come on campus, we're always on alert. So what happens is our emergency management group meets in my office. So there's 4 or 5 individuals that meet in my office as soon as something is declared, and then we deal with certain aspects. Certain individuals are assigned to communications. Others are assigned to the operations side of things. And we'll assess. Sometimes we decide not to because of the low volatility of that particular group. Like you said, we don't want to risk as if we're antagonizing them and preventing them from their right to protest on campus. So we have to weigh that with the safety and security of all in your respective buildings or libraries. Ideally is you lock down all the buildings and they could protest on Lower Field. That's not going to fly. We need to be able to show that the university is... just as long as it's peaceful and respectful, that this is a university where you're allowed to protest. But I know it causes issues at the libraries because obviously it's a long, you know, especially if I'll use McClellan Redpath, it's a decent walk and they'll bang and they'll cheer and whatnot and it disturbs the students. Some students get frustrated, might cause confrontation there. We analyze all that and try to make the best decision possible. Sometimes it backfires. But I feel so far what we needed to do was done to the best of our ability, and I think it turned out pretty well. My recommendation, same thing as in occupations, is if there are protesters and you're upset because they're making noise, let them be. Because if you confront them, that'll raise the level a little more. I understand the frustration, though. Geez, we have card access. He could have just pressed a button and it would have been locked. I understand that. But... then the repercussions the next morning is McGill doesn't permit protests, we were peaceful, we're McGill students. So we analyze that. We have our regulars. Trust me, we know them really well. So we could better gauge what type of protest it'll become. And it might happen that they enter the your building after they entered another building and everything went fine in the other building. So, but sometimes your building is the first, or McClellan is the first building they enter because through McTavish, for example. So we gauge. It's not arbitrary. It really isn't. I'll get emails either from Diane or Bruna in terms of, okay, are we locking down now? Are we? It's not arbitrary. It really isn't. But the decision lies on my shoulders, and the reason why, I need to control the whole campus. I need to control what's going on the whole campus. And if people are locking down their own buildings and then my staff have to get in for an emergency pertaining to that situation, they can't because they got locked out and they got surprised, the coordination needs to be done at one place, and it's done in my office. But I try as much as possible, even though sometimes I try to be up to the minute, almost like play-by-play commentator. When I do something, I let the appropriate individuals know that that's what I'm doing. Sometimes I'm a little late, but understand that the decisions are being taken, and I have to at the same time tell people what decision I'm taking. So, but the priority for me is to make the decision. So then I advise.
I have two questions here.
Yeah.
First one is, in what ways are security personnel required to identify themselves? Number two, do you have any advice for protecting ourselves from riot police on or near campus?
Okay, so the first question is identifying?
Yes.
Okay. Security personnel all have security permits from the Bureau de Sécurité Privée. They all have it on them. They must have it on them. We had situations where individuals were approached our personnel to identify themselves while they were doing what they needed to do to protect the campus. So they were doing their job and they were being somewhat harassed for ID. What I tell my staff is, if you're doing your job and you can't show your ID, tell them to come to the security office and we'll confirm that you're a McGill or agency employee. So they're compelled to the limit that they can do so. That's my answer for that one, because it's not the first time I hear it. And the second one, sorry, right, protect from riot police.
Do you have any advice for protecting ourselves from riot police on or around campus?
Yeah, with all due respect to that question, I'm not going to tell you how to protect yourself from the police, because the police are, for me, are the good guys. So there's not much protection to be done. Stay away from situations that you shouldn't be in. Maybe, because that's what happens, right? Once the riot police come in, and for example, they'll call a demonstration illegal, for example, and you must disperse. If you don't disperse, they'll treat you as an individual that is there to cause havoc. My recommendation is stay away. But I'm not going to say protect yourself, with all due respect to the question or to the individual that's asking it. I'm not going to tell you how to protect yourself from the police, because the cooperation and collaboration we have with the Montreal police is phenomenal, and they're our colleagues, so that's my answer. Okay.
Other questions from near or far? Make sure I look at the corners. Well, I just have to say thank you very,
thank you.
Very much, and we will obviously be getting back to you, there's no doubt. It's important that we're all trained, that we do have, pay attention to prevention instead of
reaction and repression. Right.
And to know what to do under certain under all circumstances. So I really appreciate it. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us.
At this time when.
Thank you.
But we know you're very busy. And as I said, you've gotten more than three people. You've gotten to at least 100.
Good.
Yes, so.
Well, thank you for your time. Yes. Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
We'll just continue with where we were here.
This is weird. Where's our little? There we are. Okay.
Okay, Diane.
Great, thanks. We have just 5 minutes, Colleen, or as long as it takes. Couple minutes. This won't take long.
Yeah,
make it snappy. Good, very good. Well, I just wanted to give you an update on what I think is a really wonderful part of all of our jobs, and that's working with the SSMU Library Improvement Fund. This year, the students levy $10 per undergraduate, and this has been happening for a number of years, which is matched by centrally by the Development and Alumni Relations. So this year we had just a little over $650,000 from the students. They are led by a Library Improvement Fund coordinator who surveyed his student groups, and they received and democratically selected 10 projects this year, which I'm just going to quickly highlight. First, they're giving over $444,000 towards the renovation of the third floor of the McLennan Library Building. They're also contributing to the Education Library to install more compact shelving, which will free up space for student group study and quiet study space. They contribute to a student navigator funding, and then just some wonderful one-offs that the students ask for: furniture, microfilm reader, DVDs, classics material. They're purchasing several thousand dollars worth of Macs to loan out. Plus, we're hiring students to work with both Office for Students with Disabilities and with us for e-exam and an interesting OSD project. So we have other groups that contribute. The Postgraduate Student Society also has a Library Improvement Fund, and we're working with them now on finalizing the projects they want to support. Arts Undergraduate Society, also about $80,000. So the students are so committed, they put their money where their mouth is, and we're listening to them and implementing it. So a couple of facilities updates. There's going to be a lot of activity in the McLennan Library Building. First, the management material is coming off the fourth floor and being merged into the main collection, which will free the fourth floor up for compact shelving for RARE, which is desperately needed. So you'll see that happening after the third floor is done. Of course, we have the Redpath main floor work underway, and when the loans desk moves and our staff are moved into their new staff area, then that area will become student space. The third floor renovation of McLennan is going to be a noisier floor. There will be group study areas. There are four new group study rooms being renovated. It will be zoned by color, and hopefully with proper signage and our students understanding, if I want to be noisy, I'll go to that floor, it will possibly make the other floors quieter. So we'll see how that goes. And that's planned for a launch in September. It's just a floor plan, which is impossible to follow, so we'll move past. The Education Library, you can see, and my faithful assistant will just show where the...
Basically, in education, what we're going to be doing is, this is the section where we're going to be installing the compact shelving. Currently, there's these two sections. They're already compact shelving, so we're just going to expand this space, and then at the same time we're trying to look throughout the space and see, identify the areas where we can maybe do some upgrades and some improvements, which is, for example, the group zone area here, adding group zone, adding the student seating area in here. Currently there's only the one in the middle, so we're expanding this, removing the shelves that are in here, giving that area to the students as well. And then this quiet zone, which is currently where we have the black carrels and so on. So in reality, by doing the compact shelving, we're going to alleviate the space and bring a much cleaner picture to the library. Right.
Thank you. Life Sciences, where we're located in their building now, the new staff room on the fourth floor, the work will begin in mid-May. So we're looking forward to that
project being completed for you. And the CyberMed on the second floor, deconstruction work, they're going to keep us informed on when that deconstruction work will begin. We're expecting it approximately.
Initially, it was around August. Probably we're going to start sometime in July. What's really important in here is for the fourth floor, I mean, work is starting mid-May, so we're planning around the 18th. They're going to start renovating that room. So expect, in the deconstruction, expect a little noise. Once that's done, then everything's going to go run smoothly.
Did you want to step? Yeah, great. Thank you. And any questions before HR? Yes.
I saw the color coding. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Oh, sure. I'll just go back to the incomprehensible picture. And essentially, when you think of the floors of McLennan, the Sherbrooke zone will be a color, gray, so that when people say, meet me in the gray zone, those are the bookable carrels. Where there's quieter seating, there'll be a different color than the group study zone. So that's the principle behind it. Yeah, we're starting with this floor, and I like that feedback, because as we look at renovating the main floor of McLennan and Redpath, the major project, that's important to think about how we do that with color as well, color and material.
I think the students will love that.
Great, thank you.
I just have to mention a couple of things about this floor, because notice there is wavy furniture over there. It's 35 years of looking at stuff that was all in a line that I said we have to have something that's got waves. And these corners and across from the elevator lobbies are really experimental group spaces. We're really trying to make them as versatile as absolutely possible, putting lots of things on wheels, comfier furniture that kids can move around, walls that you can write on. We'll have to have markers someplace where kids can take them out. And then we know that someone's going to write on them with a permanent marker, and we have to paint them every year. So it's just part of the process. But we hope to learn from this so that we can incorporate these ideas into our other plans.
One last thing just to mention on this layout was the compact shelving that is going to be installed in this section as well. So it's going to be the same as the fifth or the sixth floor. There's going to be the four sections. That's going to happen at the same time of the whole renovation. Is there any other question? Isabel?
Good afternoon. So we were busy with the different search committee into identifying new future librarians and communication administrator. So tomorrow we'll complete the last interview for the life science librarian. Our candidate is Martin Morris, and after tomorrow the committee will meet and deliberate on who we will be recommending to the dean. We have identified our communication administrator, the replacement of Marika, and we're at the final stage now of negotiations, so we should have someone in place relatively soon. The next round of interviews will be for Osler, the ed librarian position in Osler, and we're aiming to conduct the interviews the week of May 7. And after that, we'll be working on the next batch of posting, which is the replacement in Schulich, Matlieve, and Rare Books for now. So, and about the retirement incentive, we had our information session a few weeks ago. Good success. I still have packages with me. So for the people who would like to have the package, please call me or send me an email, and I will make sure that you receive them. And we're trying to get a new session, information session, organized also. So I will keep you informed of the date. So that's it for HR. That's it. Thank you.
Oh,
for.
Is this one animated? I don't know. No. Okay. Yeah. We don't. Yeah, we get the picture. We don't get quite all the bells and whistles with Marika being gone. But apparently she left a couple of them for me, so I like these. So I just welcome any sorts of questions on any issues about what we've been talking about or anything else from near or far. You got to go to the microphone. Yeah, you aren't loud enough for the 60. I think we've got about 65 people who are tuned in. Even they can't hear you, Angela.
Colleen, I have two questions for you.
Okay.
The first one
is this a test that I have to remember both at the same time? Okay.
Isabel mentioned retirement incentive.
Mm-hmm.
Are you able to tell us any of your plans? It's very difficult to predict how many of our potential staff will actually take this package, but are there plans in case they all decide to take this package? Since we're going to, for every two staff members that we lose, we can only replace one, and since they are leaving at the most critical time, August 30th, what are the plans that you have made to have a very successful fall semester with less staff in the libraries?
Well, first, if everyone left, I think it would be like 62 people. I mean, we've told you that our demographics are really skewed. And I don't know if people knew that they were that skewed. They are enormously skewed. We have a bipodal distribution. If people know a little bit about this, we've got people here and we've got people here and we don't have people in the middle. So no, there aren't going to be 62 people who leave. And we do have, this is an issue that I spoke with the provost and with Lynn Gervais about when I saw the juxtaposition of the two programs going on, just at the time that we're encouraging, that we're doing retirement incentives, we have this one for two thing. And I have assurance that since we're the main place on campus that's trying to do that, that all of that won't come on from our hide. And honestly, we will be making those adjustments as we need to, and I'm not alarmed at this point. The amount of money, I think, as I recall, I can't remember this quite, but the amount of money that we have to make up in this two-for-one switcheroo thing, I think, is $1 million, and it's 100 positions from all over campus. So, just regular turnover is going to do that. And they aren't going to take, for 100 positions, basically, they aren't going to take 20% of them from one place. So not to worry, Angela. We're on top of it.
Well, I am worried.
I know, but that's my job. You can relax. In other words, with this right now, there's not, I can tell you this, I am not at all alarmed because I have an idea of what's going on with the process and how many people are taking advantage of it and what some of our other movements are around. We're not going to have a problem, Angela. We're not going to have a problem. If we do, I'll let you know.
Okay. My second question concerns hours, library hours. Next week, we're moving to, I guess, shoulder hours, and then in June, we'll go into summer hours.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the website for many of the libraries states that the libraries will open at 9 and provide service at 9. Is this correct?
Yeah, it depends upon library, and it's not updated, I guess.
Okay.
I don't know. What?
No, what she's referring to is that it said people have service at 9 and Ed didn't change it.
Oh, okay. So it's a matter of just changes being made in due course, and they're just were changed today.
Can I find out from other libraries that are starting to provide service at 10 but are opening at 9 that are in a situation similar to ours? I assume many libraries are opened by security at 9 o'clock and they're left open unattended between 9 and 10. Is this what happens at McLennan?
No. No. But there are lots of people around. And all of those things have been hours and services for the summer have been discussed ad infinitum, ad nauseum at our dean's cabinet meetings. And anybody who was there knows exactly what I mean. And our weekly branch heads meetings. And Susan has well represented y'all's needs as well as knowing what's going on with the other libraries.
I'm trying to,
The light is just in a bizarre place.
Okay.
Yeah. I think this may help. Susan, thank you.
No, the information has been communicated to staff, and I know that there's still some uneasiness to the fact that we'll open the doors, and yet who is really responsible between 9 and 10 for the security? I think that's more of the issue because we don't have a service point that's open. We've talked about it at Life Sciences, and we've kind of worked out how we think we're going to handle it, but mm-hmm. it may be a problem for a number of the other libraries that this is a new thing for us about how we handle that 1 hour.
Yeah. It's good to know that Health Sciences is taking care of it and Life Sciences is taking care of it. We have gone over this with every single library like crazy, and they are all comfortable with how this is working. Each branch head has basically been in charge of these hours. Okay? Don't worry about it. I mean, really, they're taking care of their own lives. They really are.
But what we've decided is librarians are going to open the library at 9. Is this happening in other libraries as well? And we're not going to do anything between 9 and 10 other than open the library. So a user comes in and says, I'd like to borrow a reserved book, and we have to say, no, you have to wait until 10. Why are we opening the libraries and yet not providing service for 1 hour?
I can guarantee you. Okay, I understand. These discussions have been talked about, as I said, ad infinitum, ad nauseum. It's not the time or the place to discuss all of that sausage making here again. It has gotten to the point where believe me, it's done. We'll learn from our errors if there are problems and how it's going to work, but we're okay. Each branch head has got this under control, I've been assured. Okay? Other questions? You know, it's not that people have control over their own lives. That's a little bit about what I struggle with here. If it's not going to work, we get to change it. We make up the rules, we get to change the rules when we learn that that things don't work the way we want to. So we're going to try it this way. If it doesn't work, we'll change it. Believe me, the branch heads are not, they are not a quiet group that doesn't feel that they need to say what they need to say when they need to say it. And it's not being handled uniformly in every branch, because I don't think things should be handled uniformly all the time in every single place. Okay? Other thoughts, questions from near or far?
I had a suggestion.
Uh-huh. Yeah, just a right. Yeah, service starts a sign suggested, you know, at the desk. Service starts at whatever, and we can do that. Okay. Okay, other questions? Bruna, anybody from all the 60 people out in the hinterlands? Okay. Thank you. I know that it seems like we're having meeting after meeting after meeting, and right now there are just so many issues of our times that we have to do this. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.